Washington, Thursday, July 31st. In just a moment, I'll tell you what we're thinking about here today.
From Washington, the American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations present Jack Bell, substituting for Borkage, with his midday summary of Washington and world news. Before Mr. Bell tells the story of today's news, here's an announcement of interest to all of us. What's your knowledge of the State of the Union? Do you know what's happening in America's labor ranks today? What big business is thinking and doing? Do you know our current foreign affairs policy? If your score is low, then it's time you do something about your state of knowledge. You can do this by keeping up on the news through newspapers, magazines, radio commentators, and radio public forums such as America's Town Meeting of the Air. This is the noted hour-long discussion program that brings you leading authorities in a formative debate on current controversial issues facing America as well as the whole world. Each week, these experts argue all sides of some vital political problem or question. Start tonight. Listen to America's Town Meeting. Now here is Mr. Bell.
On the plains of Sharon, scene of many of the Old Testament battles, a new deed of violence has taken place. Early today, British soldiers found the hanged bodies of two British sergeants who had been kidnapped and held as hostages by the Jewish underground organization called Irgun. When the British soldiers sought to cut down the bodies of their comrades, an explosion occurred. One of the bodies had been booby-trapped. It was blown to bits. An eucalyptus tree to which both were hanged was uprooted. A British guardsman was severely wounded in the face, and newsmen were knocked down by the blast. The scene was a grove a few miles south of Netanya, in the area where a mysterious telephone voice had told correspondents the bodies would be found. At the same time, the voice warned that the ground about the bodies had been heavily mined. So this morning early, the British approached very cautiously, testing the ground all around with those devices by which they detected mines during the war. No mines were found, but when the first body was touched directly, it exploded in their faces. Pinned to the bodies were inscriptions in Hebrew stating that the men had been executed by the Jewish resistance movement after arrest and formal trial. But the story all along has been that Irgun had kidnapped the men and had openly warned that they would be killed if three members of Irgun were executed by the British. So it was retaliation on kidnapped hostages rather than a legal execution under the Articles of War. The illegal side of it was brought out by the more moderate elements in the Jewish community. Netanya's mayor, Ovid Ben-Ami, sadly commented, "This is the most brutal crime they have done yet. All we have built for and prayed for now lies in the dust." The Jewish Agency and the Jewish National Council issued a statement. And I think it can't be too much emphasized that the whole Jewish community does not support these acts of violence. Listen to the wording of their statement. "We have no words to express our execration of the dastardly murder of two innocent men by a set of criminals who are impervious to the voice of conscience and arrogate unto themselves the power to decide on matters of life and death. We call upon the Jewish community in Palestine and the whole Jewish people to stand by our side in fighting this ghastly evil which has befallen us until its complete eradication from our midst. We express our deep and heartfelt sympathy to the relatives of the innocent victims of this horrible deed. We beg them and their people not to identify with them, the Jewish people, which is engaged in an effort to build up its national life." The British are now mapping a more rigid campaign against underground violence. They're expected to ask the moderate Jewish agency to help them stamp it out by cooperating actively. Heretofore, the moderate groups have refused, saying they preferred to combat the extremists in their own way. A somewhat amusing sidelight on the jumpiness of the British about Jewish underground attacks has come to light from San Pedro, California. An officer on the British cruiser Kenya was looking at the water nearby and he saw a lot of bubbles coming up. He immediately thought of underwater saboteurs like the frogmen off the coast of Palestine who have sunk British vessels. He ordered the dropping of demolition charges into the water. It was later found that the bubbles were caused by the exhaust from an auxiliary engine. And speaking of blowing up ships or the fear of ships being blown up, Brooklyn longshoremen have refused to load a vessel carrying ammonium nitrate. They feared the same thing happening there in Brooklyn as happened at the Texas City disaster and here only a couple of days ago in the harbor of Brest, France. It may lead to New York barring from the port any vessels carrying this dangerous stuff. It's a strange thing that ammonia nitrate has been handled for years without trouble. Only one or two isolated cases of it exploding had occurred until the last year, and then two of them happened. Boom, boom. And very bad ones at that. I can't say I blame the longshoremen. They'd have to pay me more than $1.65 an hour to go near that stuff. Things are still looking very serious for England's economy. On top of slashes in the military establishment and plans to have the miners work an extra hour per day, the government is now considering the idea of reducing the almost irreducible diet of the people of those islands. More austerity is what they call it. It may finally force the issue of whether the Labour government over there is to stand or fall. Prime Minister Clement Attlee is apparently squeezed by without being chucked out by his own party, but he may yet hear from the British housewives. I never think of Clement Attlee without thinking of the crack that Winston Churchill made about him. Attlee, he said, is a very modest man, but then he has a great deal to be modest about. There's been a little demonstration at the Soviet embassy here in Washington. Probably done as a publicity stunt purely. Maybe I shouldn't help them out by talking about it. But anyhow, two men drove up in a car this morning and began nailing signs on trees in the Soviet embassy yard. The signs read, "Spies, beware." A small crowd gathered. Then the embassy first secretary came out and asked the men to wait until the police should arrive. They said no thanks and drove off. Embassy employees took the signs down. The two men said they represented the Christian Youth of America. One of them edits a magazine which is published by the Reverend Gerald L.K. Smith, who is so far on the right wing politically that he is constantly assailed as a fascist. Now for an announcement. I'll be back with more news and comment in a moment.
Here's a question for you young women who will soon be finishing your high school education. What are your plans for the future? Well, if it's a career, I've got some tips for you on one of the most worthwhile professions any young woman can follow. It's a career in nursing. A student nurse receives a fine education at a cost far less than university training for any other profession. She lives in a dormitory or nursing home just as she would at college and gets time off every week as well as summer vacations. Today, nursing is also one of the better paid professions. So, if you're considering a career and you're a high school graduate between 17 and 35, investigate the advantages a career in nursing offers. Contact the director of nurses at your nearest hospital for information regarding schools of nursing. It's a worthwhile profession. Look into it soon. Now, here again is Mr. Bell with his commentary on the news.
Yesterday, I went over to the Chancery of the Netherlands Embassy. Dr. Eelco van Kleffens, the new ambassador, was having his first press and radio conference. I went because I wanted to hear the Dutch side of the Indonesian story, and also, I wanted to see Dr. van Kleffens. He's renowned for his work as foreign minister of his country and for being the Netherlands representative on the UN Security Council. Now that Dr. Benisch has gone under the Iron Curtain, I suppose you could call Dr. van Kleffens the smartest little statesman in Europe. I wanted to see such a man close up, and I also wanted to confirm with my own eyes the testimony of the camera and the stories I'd heard of his personal appearance. Dr. van Kleffens, like another great man, Abraham Lincoln, knows the value of being homely. There's one story I remember particularly about him. It is when the Germans had invaded Holland. A party of Dutch refugees had just landed on the closely guarded shores of England. The military nabbed them, of course, and they were very suspicious indeed of the man who said he was the foreign minister of Holland, even though he had papers. A British officer got in touch with the Foreign Office in London, told the situation. The voice on the other end of the line said, "Describe him." Before the officer had said more than 10 words, the Foreign Office said, "Yes, that's the man, all right. There couldn't be two who look like that." When I came into the spacious meeting room of the Chancery, where about 50 people had gathered, I was a little disappointed in Dr. van Kleffens. He didn't quite live up to his advance notices about being homely. I would say that he resembles an artist's conception of what European man will look like when he has evolved another 1,000 years. Forehead more bulging than one sees ordinarily. Chin more receding. Baldness more pronounced. His nose was the beak of a bird. His eyes were the most startling part about him. He He's the only man I ever saw who has China blue eyes, which are penetrating at the same time. Dr. Van Kleffens told us his country's side of the Indonesian situation, and I'll give it to you for what it's worth. Some left thinking he had made out a good case. Others thought he didn't have a case, but had made the best of what he had. Dr. Van Kleffens' first remark was disarming. He said he knew the phrase of the Indonesians, "We are fighting for our liberty," would strike a responsive chord in Americans. "It strikes a responsive chord in our hearts, too," he said, "we who fought 80 years for our liberty from Spain." He then asked who the true champions of liberty were, the leaders of the so-called Indonesian Republic or the Dutch. He said that only Sumatra and Java were in a state of resistance, that the inhabitants of the other Dutch East Indies islands, Borneo, the Celebes, and the Moluccas, and countless smaller islands, 20 million people all told, were entirely happy, and their leaders had even urged the Dutch to take this police action that is now going on. At this point, a secretary came in and whispered to Dr. Van Kleffens. He excused himself very matter-of-factly by saying that The Hague was calling him on the phone. When he returned, he said it was not true that the Dutch were trying to destroy the Indonesian Republic. They had wanted to work with the leaders of it, and they had even recognized those leaders last October and made agreements with them. The Dutch government had insisted then that the Indonesians stop making treaties with foreign powers, that they recognize the other states like Borneo and the Celebes as independent, and not try to run their governments too. The leaders had agreed but hadn't kept their promise. What the Indonesians had been trying to do, said Dr. Van Kleffens, his China blue eyes sweeping around the room, would be like the state of Nevada trying to name the governors of Utah or New Mexico. Another thing the native leaders had agreed on was not to blockade the Dutch-held cities, but they had failed to live up to that agreement, too. Since October, there had been more than 1,000 violations of the agreement, he said. Dr. Van Kleffens then said that what purported to be an Indonesian government was not a government at all. It didn't keep order. Its own troops didn't obey it. The leaders just had a microphone. The whole thing had been started by the Japanese. When the Japs were on the verge of being beaten and forced to quit the East Indies, said the ambassador, they had wanted to leave a time bomb behind them. They called in Sukarno, the present leader of the Indonesians, and permitted him to arm young men who now go about in irresponsible bands, terrorizing the populace as well as fighting the Dutch. He didn't mean to say that theirs was a terroristic government exactly, but a large element among them liked plunder and the chance to pillage and take over what was not theirs. "These armed bands must be disarmed," he said. "Responsible people must be found who would not disavow their agreements." This the Dutch were trying to bring about, and they had no desire to enslave or treat the people of the Indies as servants or colonials. They merely wanted to treat them as equal partners. No one regretted more than the Dutch that strong measures had to be taken. They had put it off as long as possible, but now every element in the kingdom supported them except the communists. At this point, I asked Dr. Van Kleffens if a new story was true that his government had asked the British to mediate the Indonesian conflict. Dr. Van Kleffens smiled gently and said that was just what he had been talking to The Hague about on the telephone. No, there was not a word of truth to the story. That's all, and thanks very much. Now here's a friendly word from your announcer.
Have you heard Break the Bank, radio's biggest money quiz show? Yes, it's on the air over most of these ABC stations every Friday night. Many people have wondered how Break the Bank contestants are selected. Well, during the warm-up preceding the show, MC Burt Parks asks if there are, for example, any lawyers or carpenters in the audience, keeping in mind the questions on the blackboard. Movie fans or card experts may be in demand for one show, while students of literature or sports enthusiasts may be called for another show. Well, according to Parks, specialists have the best chance for breaking the bank, which has at times exceeded $5,000 and always contains at least $1,000. This Friday night, see how your knowledge compares with that of the contestants. Hear Break the Bank when it's broadcast Friday nights over most of these same ABC stations. Mr. Bell, substituting for Borkage, will be heard tomorrow at this time over most of these stations with his summary of Washington and world news. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.